Welcome to Climate Levers. This is the podcast that shares stories about the people who fight climate change by protecting and regenerating Earth's natural systems. Why does the world need regenerative communities? And what might it be like to live in one? This episode of Climate Levers will try to answer some of the questions you're likely to have about how successful regenerative communities might be structured and operated. We'll look at this topic from the perspective of one group that has pored over this topic for years. I'm David Veronica, your host. Please meet Alex Koren, CEO and co-founder of a company that focuses on overcoming a crucial obstacle for regenerative communities. That obstacle is access to land. Alex's company, ReCommon, enables the management of land assets, governance, and systems that successful regenerative communities are likely to need.
We are flooded every day with examples of how things can go wrong and different versions of the dystopian future that we don't want. But one of the things that we're really trying to do is to create a very clear path forward where people can access an alternative reality and access a positive future in a very not abstract way. Like, we don't need flying cars, futuristic cities. Like, we can do this now. We just need to piece it together. But all the solutions are out there. And it's really just, I think what we're doing is more than anything, weaving together these solutions in such a way that hopefully it does provide hope for people and a clear path of like, oh, maybe I could live in a place like that with my family. Maybe that could work for me and my friends and my loved ones.
I want to emphasize that for the most part, the planning of regenerative communities is still in the conceptual stages. This year, 2024, we'll likely see a few communities move into experimental or proof-of-concept stages here in the United States and elsewhere. Even in these early days, it's clear that regenerative communities will vary widely from one bioregion to another, depending on the physical characteristics and the needs of the natural systems in their locale. For impact investors, it's already clear that regenerative communities will offer many different kinds of investment opportunities and asset classes. Each will offer its own risk-adjusted rate of return. The investment opportunities will be diverse. They'll appeal to a broad range of impact investors, and they'll be attractive to investors with widely varying goals and expectations for returns. Those details are starting to emerge now, and they will become much clearer within the next year. Now back to Alex Koren, whose Colorado-based company is working to establish regenerative communities in the Rocky Mountain region of the United States.
Our goal is for a network of resilient bioregional communities. What we're trying to do in Colorado is really just the hopefully first and the proving grounds, but an example for others to follow. And the reason that we feel like we need to do that is because we've been working on these frameworks and these governance models and capital formation structures for several years now. So we're probably the ones to implement it as well, at least to try it out. But because all of the things we're working on are really kind of long time horizon projects and long term thinking, so our flagship, our MVP here, might take 5 to 10 years to realize or more. But by the end of my life, I'm hoping that that has shown itself to work and that similar regenerative villages are popping up all over the world using the frameworks and technology that we've developed.
Let's return for a moment to the definition of regenerative communities and their purpose. A regenerative community is a village, town, or city whose primary purpose is to regenerate the natural environment on which it's built, as well as its surrounding areas. Regenerative communities serve three main purposes. First, they regenerate, that is, repair or restore, natural systems that human activity has destroyed or depleted. By regenerating nature, I mean that they increase soil health and biodiversity, protect and restore sources of clean water, and protect or restore air quality. They also help to reduce climate change by restoring health to natural systems that absorb carbon from the atmosphere. Second, regenerative communities efficiently grow nutritious food in ways that improve the natural environment. And third, regenerative communities provide a social organization for people who want to live in harmony with nature and to repair nature by applying regenerative principles. Such communities enable people to share a mutually beneficial life. People are united in villages, towns, or small cities that provide food, camaraderie, health, social support, and the other essentials of a balanced, resilient, and happy life. Regenerative communities matter because we've overexploited Earth's natural resources. We've exceeded 6 of the planet's 9 natural boundaries, and we're on our way to exceeding still more. As a reminder, here's a simplified list of the 6 planetary boundaries we've already breached. Biodiversity, climate change, integrity of land systems, including forests, availability of fresh water, pollution from man-made chemicals, and human-caused disruption of natural nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. The results of these breaches are likely to make Earth much less hospitable for human life. Here's Alex again.
We can see history is a story of civilizations that have risen and fallen. And we are foolish to think that for some reason, our current iteration of civilization is immune to these forces of rising and falling and collapse, especially when you look at our track record and what we've done to the planet. It seems pretty inevitable that we're going to go the way of these civilizations that have come before us, and we're going to collapse. The exact reason and timeline, I don't think anyone can accurately predict, but we can speak to the forces that are leading to collapse. And so for me, and really our approach at Recommon, it's not a question of like, how do we fix it for everyone? How do we save the world? Because the truth is that this current iteration of our civilization, it may not be able to be saved. We need a new version. We need new systems. We need new models. And we need to build them in resilient ways that are collapse aware and that are ready to take on the storm that's coming. Because a lot of people's reaction to this stuff when they first learn about it is, I'm going to build a bunker and I'm going to stockpile food and ammo and, you know, build a big fence around my property or something. But that is not a long-term solution. What is a long-term solution is building resilient communities with strong local economies and building it in such a way that they're in resonance with the natural world around them, truly place-based communities, because then we have neighbors to rely on. We have local food systems to rely on, local water systems and water infrastructure to rely on. We don't have to rely on this fragile, fragmented patchwork of systems that's currently supporting civilization in a way that is destroying the planet. So whatever is coming next, it's going to be through the context of the collapse of our current civilization in one form or another.
If a collapse occurs, we may not have centralized infrastructures such as national power grids or national telecommunication systems or even global supply chains. These are all elements that enable our globalized industrial society today. And all of these things may go away at some stage in a broad collapse. They may, in fact, go away fairly early in a collapse. The idea of developing local communities within bioregions seems to suggest that each bioregion could to some degree be self-supporting or self-sustaining. A bioregion needn't necessarily depend on importing grain from another country, for example. Is that right?
That's exactly right. It's resilient, local, place-based bioeconomies established in a bioregional context and supported by communities of stewards that are part of the landscape themselves. And the funny thing about this is that it gets very doomer when you start looking at collapse and start talking about it, you know, going the bunker route and stockpiling ammo and food and canned food and stuff like that is pretty doomer also. But if you go the other direction and you start to really understand that we're tribal creatures and that we belong in community and that we can live in community that's place-based and connected to the land, and we can grow our own food systems, and we can live in homes that aren't made of toxic materials and, you know, are designed to take in the sunlight and warm us in the winter and cool us in the summer, and that we can have, you know, gardens embedded into community structures, all of a sudden the preparation for collapse starts to just look like a good life, where you know your neighbors and you have healthy food to eat and clean water. And I think that's kind of the irony of all of this, is that the best preparation that we could do for collapse is really going towards more of a wholesome existence, where we're reconnected to place and to neighbors and to our food sources and to our water sources. And we're participating in an economy where money's staying locally. And so when things happen, when power grids fail, when major storms roll through and disrupt transportation, whatever it might be, those communities can act as a lifeboat and can act as a buffer against all of those forces.
Let's look at specific, concrete, and practical considerations. What might a regenerative community look and feel like to the people who live and work in it?
So there's a lot of different flavors of what a regenerative community could look like, but I'll speak to kind of the version that we're working on here and supporting and would love to see emerge here at ReCommon. So one of the key issues facing farmers today, there's like a two-handed side. For one, there's aging farmers that can't take care of their land anymore and don't necessarily have kin to pass it on to. Also, their retirement plan is often wrapped up in the cost of the farm. And the only people that can afford it are either the banks or large institutional corporate farms. So that puts the young farmer that wants to get on some land into a pretty tough spot. And so one of the key aspects of the regenerative communities that we're hoping to support with our work is this sense that the land itself is held in trust and can be accessed by the farmer without them needing to buy it. So they could get a 99-year renewable leasehold to be a farmer on that land. And that leasehold could specify that certain ecological farming practices need to be used. And so for someone who's really excited about regenerative agriculture, but they don't have the money to buy a farm, this could be the perfect inroad. Not only are they connecting into an aligned community that shares their values, but they're able to get onto a farm that's been preserved and held in trust way more affordably. And this fundamentally changes the dynamics that that farmer experiences, because if a young farmer were to just go to a bank or some other lender and say, hey, I need a loan, I'm going to buy a farm, and then even beyond just buying the farm, I need to get all this equipment and I need to get seeds every year and all of this stuff, it creates this requirement for creating a bunch of profit to pay back the loan. That kind of forces that farmer into focusing on maximizing profit instead of focusing on growing the most nutrient-dense food and focusing on growing food in a way that is harmonious with the surrounding environment. And it pushes them towards more extractive practices, maybe using chemical pesticides, maybe, you know, tilling the soil aggressively despite the long-term degradation that that causes. So by changing the ownership and access to that land for that farmer, it fundamentally changes the economic incentive structure and allows them to focus on just growing healthy food to support the community.
What attractions do regenerative communities offer for people who don't want to be farmers?
So I think to best answer that question, it's worth framing some of the problems with existing communities. So the options that a lot of people have today, and of course, there are beautiful places to live, and this may not apply to everybody, but by and large, most people are forced into quickly stick-built, cookie-cutter homes in subdivisions. That is the way that the development has happened here in the U.S. for decades now. Right now, I live in the mountains, which is kind of a different version, right? It's a bunch of single-family homes just tucked into the woods instead of tucked into a subdivision. But it creates this sense of, you know, you're in your home and you get into your car and you drive from your car to wherever you need to go and you park and then you go into another place and do what you got to do and you go back in your car and back home. And That is really not a gratifying way to be. For many people in the Western world, it's kind of all we know, which is really unfortunate, and which is why it's such a culture shock to go walk around, you know, a city in Italy or in France, and that has been there for hundreds of years and has more of this good urbanism, gentle density design built into it. Beyond the kind of functionality that's missing from these communities that people live in today, there's a sense that the house that they're living in is likely built of toxic materials and that it is really not built to last. It is likely disconnected from the urban core, and to live in that urban core means a sacrifice in maybe being close to nature and being around a bunch of things you don't want. At the same time, there's this lack of alignment in values, right? There's so many people that need a place to live and are brought to live places sometimes because of work or because of school or lifestyle choices. But for most people, there's this sense that they want something. And maybe if people in particular listening to this podcast and that would be curious about a regenerative community, there's something inherently missing from where they live. They don't maybe have the same values or desires that their neighbors have. All of that put together, including thinking about energy infrastructure and the energy requirements to power these homes, and then to power the vehicles that take them anywhere for anything they need outside of the home, it becomes this very degenerative community style. And a lot of these communities that are built in the mainstream way from day one, even before people move in, they're degenerative. They are a tax on resources. They are a constant drain to the local environment and need upkeep and further aspects that just require this further degradation of the environment to support these communities. And so the alternative looks like living in healthier homes that are more efficient, that are running on clean energy, you know, being in a community design that is more conducive to walking and biking and alternative modes of transportation, and does bring them closer to healthy, locally grown food and clean water and a healthy surrounding environment.
Tell me more about what the built environment of a regenerative community might look like.
Oftentimes, regen community projects focus on the natural world. And when people think of regenerative, often they think of, oh, soil and plants. But the built environment is just as important to creating regenerative communities as the relationships in the natural environment. And similar to how certain patterns can be recognized and used in the natural world, there are certain patterns and formulas that can be followed in the built environment as well that create beautiful spaces that are human scaled and are designed for really optimal human living. A lot of this is generally encompassed in a movement and philosophy known as good urbanism, which stemmed out of the new urbanism movement. But really, what's so nice about this good urbanism movement is that it looks at these places, right? Anyone who's listening, you know, can imagine a quaint European village that people go on vacation to. Maybe you're lucky enough to live there, but these tighter streets, you know, the buildings are, you know, 2, 3, maybe 4 stories high. There's usually stores on the bottom, residences on the top. The streets are winding. There's benches. There's parks. There are different public squares and public places that are nice to sit and enjoy. There's trees lining streets. And then right outside of those areas are typically natural spaces for agriculture or for wild areas. And a lot of those things I just mentioned are design principles. No, this isn't some magic sauce that can't be achieved that only the builders of, you know, of cities from centuries ago could do. There is a formula to this. And what it leads to is creating places that people want to spend time in, where there's more economic activity, that reduces car dependency, creates more natural interaction amongst people, and creates safer streets too.
It sounds like the success of a regenerative community depends on its residents sharing some set of core values.
These regenerative communities, of course, are self-selecting in a sense. You know, people opt into them and choose to go to them. You are going to be more closely aligned with your neighbors. You're going to share those values of, yes, we don't want to be spraying glyphosate on the park lawns that our children and dogs are playing in, right? Like, that is something that we all can agree on. It shouldn't be that difficult. But in mainstream communities, that could be years and years and years of battling boards of trustees to change their community landscaping plans. So it really is this lifestyle alignment. And for people that are sensitive to the dire conditions that our world is facing and these various crises that we're experiencing, it is a way to fundamentally make a difference that has ripple effects beyond what someone experiences in their daily life. Like, and by that, I mean switching from that degenerative lifestyle. Even if you're recycling in your home, if you're in one of these cookie cutter subdivisions, it's inherently degenerative. By shifting and moving yourself and your family to one of these communities, you're creating a better footprint on planet Earth. And if we shift more and more people, eventually the masses, hopefully, to more regenerative community structures, then it really wipes away so much of this mandatory resource extraction and degradation that is a prerequisite to supporting these degenerative community designs.
So what's the spectrum of talents, insights, experience, knowledge, and so on that you would want to include in a thriving regenerative community?
Well, it takes a village to build a village. And so one way to consider it is in phasing. You know, I guess in this example, and because these regenerative villages don't really exist at large yet, it would be building them from new. And so there's the sense that in the beginning, you would need a core dedicated team of developers and planners and regenerative experts to acquire the property, work with local officials, get the plan in place to start. But once the community is built and going, there's this first phase of residents that would be needed in these communities to kind of check the boxes on these very fundamental aspects of what being in community means. So growing food, building structures. So that means people with plumbing experience, electrical experience, you know, people that can help set up and maintain the power systems, waste management systems. Food production is key. So it's really like food, shelter, water, and then community are these really basic needs. And very quickly then thereafter, as it grows, that next tier of what it means to be in community becomes really important. So if you want families to move there, there has to be schools. There has to be teachers. There has to be different forms of business. There has to be places not only to grow the food, but then to buy the food and hopefully to eat food at a restaurant. And because, like I said earlier, these communities should be more open and not closed off, there's this sense that there needs to be a way for people to come into the community to experience it even for a short period of time. So that means innkeepers or people that are managing short-term rentals, people setting up ecotourism experiences so that people can come experience that and stay there and see what's happening with this regenerative community. But really, very quickly, at a certain scale, the whole spectrum of what humans do is needed. So even people that work on the computer, like myself, are important. These different businesses and even supporting digital nomads, having co-working spaces for people to complement all of the industry and maybe more like blue-collar jobs and activities, the trades that are critical to making the community function. So though it might be front-loaded with more practical importance of who's there, at very quickly it becomes large enough to require the whole spectrum of what humans do.
Today you've heard that there's no single mold for creating regenerative communities. Each community is likely to be created in its own way. Communities will take many different forms depending on the characteristics of their bioregion, the needs of the terrain they occupy, and the wishes of their stakeholders. Even so, all truly regenerative communities will be planned, designed, built, and operated with the main purpose of restoring nature and growing in harmony with it. Nearly all communities mature and grow in stages. As new regenerative communities do so, they'll likely develop local economies that support diverse occupations, income levels, and standards of living. They will offer more of the services, amenities, and comforts of urban life while staying much closer to nature than conventional cities do. Such communities will likely offer many opportunities for impact investors in several asset classes with varying risk profiles and attractive risk-adjusted returns. In the next episode, we'll hear Alex Korn's answers to these additional questions. Is it possible to retrofit existing communities to be more regenerative? Or is it better to build entirely new communities? How small might an early stage community be? And how big might regenerative communities become? How might regenerative communities relate to other communities in their bioregion and beyond? And how can regenerative communities stay true to their main purpose of caring for nature? Please join us for the next episode.